This is Sean with Voices of Racing. I'm speaking with Dennis Smithberg. Dennis, how are you doing and where are you at right now?
I'm doing fine. I'm in southeast Iowa around Fairfield, and I've been outside this morning. It's getting hot, and I've done chores with my cows and back in the cool.
All right, so is that where you're originally born? You mentioned that you're born November 25th, 1947.
That's correct.
And what were your parents' names and what was their industries?
Everett and Jeanette Smithberg. And we had a history of selling Ford tractors and Ford cars for Jefferson Motor Company. That's the name of our county, Jefferson County. And then in 1956, my father and mother bought a Standard Oil station in town. And through the years, that expanded into two Standard Oil stations. And I was helping them in about 1956, right in there, on through until 61 as a young wrench and out on the drives. And when I was five, we went to our local county fair, and Joey Chitwood was there in the Wapello County Fair, which is a neighboring county. And I was sold on speed and cars and high performance ever since. And we went to that 3 or 4 years. And Joey Chitwood was one of the main inspirations in my career that headed me toward racing. I loved growing up working on cars and machinery, and that is sort of the start. We used to build little go-karts and drive them around sidewalks and all those kinds of things.
So what was Joey running?
Joey was running the Chitwood Thrill Show, and they'd jump ramp to ramp and have head-on
wow.
collisions in midair, and they had an entertainment with an old Model T with full of clowns, and it'd pop a wheelie and dump the clowns out the back of the car all over the track, and oh, it was just awesome. And they had several other things. They'd go motorcycles through hoops of fire. I'm sure you
wow.
can Google Joey Chitwood events and Joey Chitwood thrill shows and find some videos of those days. And his son has been involved with Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the last 15, 20 years now, too.
All right, so when you first got started, what were you running on when you first started getting out there and getting on courses?
In with the tracks and people like that, there were friends of our family that had what we called jalopies in the 50s and 60s, and there were old 46 Ford coupes and Chrysler coupes and things like that. Some of the 55 Chevys and Fords were getting into it. And we had quarter-mile tracks at fairgrounds and 3/8 miles. And Knoxville was up there at Knoxville, Iowa, where they have the World Outlaws this week, Nationals. And that's a big track. It's a nice half mile. You might be familiar with Knoxville Raceway. And so I started working around these local tracks with friends of Dad's and some of the people that had been working for us in the gas station had a car, a man named Harold Norton, and he was well known through here and had a top, we call them podium finishes now. We even went up Cedar Rapids, ran at Hawkeye Downs. You might remember where Hawkeye Downs is up there. So I helped them some, and I really got the bug, and at an early age, I could weld at 12 years old, and was tearing down engines, and by using that as a help with a person one-on-one, if you're tearing things down, you sort of see how they're put together, you can sort of pretty quickly learn how to put them back together and make them run right and get all the measurements and all of the specific clearances and things right, and input from a one-on-one helper that knows his way through them, and that's how I started. Harold Norton was another one that was here local, and he was working for my dad. And in 1960, we opened a big, brand new Standard Oil station on the best corner in town. Standard Oil bought Dad out, bought the two old stations, and we had that. And now my oldest son has that business, and his son is running it.
Wow.
And we have a good sized used car business with foreign and domestic repair. Probably we've got about 17 employees, my son does, and I'm retired to the cattle farm.
That's beautiful. All right, so kind of to keep it, when you were young, who were some of the mentors in racing that you really looked up to on the driver's side, and then also on the mechanic side that you were able to work under, just got to, you know, have different experiences with?
Well, number one would be A.J. Foyt Jr. He used to come back here in Bardol car and run, and we'd go up to Iowa State Fair and watch their races. Had several fellows that I knew from that, and they'd had gone to Indy. Names escape me on those two right now, but they probably come to me. So Mel Morris from Kelowna, Iowa was one of the stars that would win everything, and Harold Norton that worked for us also drove. And one of my cousins had a car, and he drove with Harold, and they ran all around Southeast Iowa. So that was really where I got started. The thing that I watched quite a bit in 1959, I believe it was, there was an article in the Des Moines Register about the Indy 500. We always listened to it. We never went to it. And Don Kenyon was in a picture of a car from Davenport. The Kenyons were living in Davenport at that time, Mel and Don and their parents. And Don was pictured on that, and it told a nice story about him working on this Indy car coming out of Davenport. And I thought, well, that is really neat. So those are probably the real early ones that I looked up to.
Okay.
And then in the 70s, I got lists that go on to 50 or 100 people. I've got them all written down. I can send those to you.
No. But we can you can end up mentioning a few. But, like, what were some of the favorite tracks for you to race on?
In what year period?
Well, you know, just kind of arcing, like, chronologically, I would say, from, you know, kind of when you got started and as you grew up in the industry.
Well, started out here locally in Eldon, Iowa, and Mount Pleasant, Iowa, and Burlington, Iowa, and Knoxville, Iowa, and that was basically it. I did mix a little drag racing from Cahokia, Illinois, and Cordova, Illinois, into it, too.
Okay.
With some friends at that time.
And then as you grew up, where were some of the other tracks that are more memorable that you were able to race on?
As I grew up, then we moved out to Phoenix, and I got involved with Clint Bronner, and I helped him on the old Bronner Hawk while I was going to Arizona State, and I just did odd jobs for Clint and came in and worked at night, helped him some. Then graduated into when he won Indy with Mario. I wasn't on the team traveling around, but I was helping some. And then in 71, I became a full-fledged team member for Clint on Gilmore Broadcasting with Art Pollard. And so that was my real beginning in IndyCar, and I had quite a bit of SCCA and sprint car and late models preparing cars, and I had two cars I prepared for one of the Ford dealers to run SCCA, and two cars that I'd run at Manzanita Speedway down in Phoenix on Baseline Road, which is all torn out now and made a housing development out of it. A lot of friends from down there. Carl Korbacher, that has Arizona sports shirt there in Speedway, and he sells them all over the country to race teams. His dad had a bar and grill, and so I met Carl, and when he was in high school, he was a Manzanita track photographer. So it's how these families, you just accrue so many friends and so many contacts. And I got a cousin over here. I got a cousin over there. Hey, you need help? I can get so-and-so to come from so-and-so.
Right.
And they were all over the country, and they all knew each other. So these chief mechanics of that day were friends with everybody from the old AAA association that used to have regionalized, sort of like NASCAR did, with different regions. And you came to Indy eventually as a track champion or a region champion. But PIR in Phoenix and Manzanita were the two big tracks that I learned and met so many people working with Clint Bronner.
All right, now, as far as some of the guys that, you know, race after race, I don't want to say that you were rivals, but that always kind of put on, you know, a good battle between you and them. Who were some of those guys that were personal for you, that you guys were neck and neck in a lot of different tracks and just gave each other a good competition?
That's really correct. There were some that were trying to have it out. It usually came to track championship material and maybe the last few races when the guys would get a little tough with each other and if their points were close. One story I remember Clint telling me that Jimmy Bryan was running for him, and this was at the end at the Arizona State Fairgrounds, and it was the night to have the points championship between Rathman and Bryan, and they were close in points, and Rathman ran Jimmy off of the track in turn three on the last lap, and somehow he kept it going and got around the outside of the fence and blew through the fence on four and overtook Rathman at the start finish line and won the championship. And he was throwing 2x4 pieces out of the cockpit as he came down driving with his knees. And so that, you know, they really didn't get in a fight over that. He got shoved through the fence, but he came back through the fence and wound up winning it in one turn.
That's hilarious. So, that's great.
These guys had so many stories, and it's like Charlie, you know, he's been through all of that. He probably knows that story.
Yeah, Charlie, when we originally did his first life interview, like in 2018, we got like 18 different segments. We got a ton of them, and one of them was about how when Paul Newman was at the, you know, IMS for filming the movie Winning in like the 50s, and how Charlie was they used his car, and and how after the days were done, that Newman would ride with Charlie to the liquor store and would tell him, "You better not tell anybody who I am, son, or I'm gonna get you." But then Charlie going out to California, and I vaguely remember, but they were drinking at a bar with a bunch of celebrities, and they're basically trying to drink each other under the table. And then one of them, and I can't remember if it was Charlie or Paul Newman, was crawling through the alley trying to get back to the hotel after that.
I don't doubt that story a bit, because that's how it was. And once you got an acquaintance made, you were friends.
Right.
And you might not have been anything but a first name basis with a lot of them, but they recognize you. Still today, a lot of them recognize us, and, you know, then we'll get into history. Where have you been? What have you been doing? Some of them couldn't come back for years, and that's the beauty of the old-timers organization. It makes that, and the Speedway is totally responsible for that. Coleman family clear up through into Penske, and kudos to them. I mean, they've kept it alive, and I can tell you some of the different people that were involved in getting it started. Duke Nalen was one of them, Johnny McDaniels, but those were car owners and drivers, and they're the ones that really felt this passion of there's something here. This is family. The Vukovich family, the Sachs family, some of them that lost their lives, not just at Indy, and different, you know, different tracks, but they were all connected. And it's just so interesting.
All right, so my next question is triumph and tragedy. So what are some of the major wins that you know, are some of your favorite ones that you've had? And what are some of the wrecks or almost wreck situations that are always that have always stood out?
Well, of course, Mario's win in the Bronner Hawk in 1969 is number one with me. Andy Granatelli was sponsor, and he and Clint didn't see eye to eye. Clint Bronner, who owned the Bronner Hawk, and when Mario, Clint was put on a job as chief over the Lotus four-wheel drive car in 1969 that Andy had bought, and Colin Chapman was the engineer, came from England, and they argued about the hubs and bearings being Formula One. They were light, and Clint kept saying that, you know, they won't take the ovals, the stress on the ovals with the weight going into the corners because they're bank corners, and they're just not heavy enough to take it. Well, Mario crashed it in practice and got burnt real bad, and the rest is history. There was no other cars left. It was Andretti Racing at that time because Al Dean had died, and Mario took on the race team, and Clint had that car left. It was an outdated Brabham, and they had made it for short tracks to use, and it was sort of a backup car. Well, it was the only thing left in the stable, and so Mario and Clint, they're talking, well, what are we going to do? Mario says, I don't have a car. I can't do anything. It's getting up time to finish qualifying. A couple of days, 3 days, 4 days. And so they decided we'd get that up to date for the Speedway. Jim McGee was involved on it. He was the co-mechanic. And so they called Phoenix and said, you got to get that car set up for the Speedway somehow and get it back here. Well, they got it back there, and Mario practiced in it, and it was running good, and he had a good time. He was up front. I think he had like third or fourth fast time in practice, and there wasn't enough radiator on that car to go the distance of 500 miles. That would have got too hot, and the engine would have failed, would have lost the crankshaft. So they put an oil cooler on it. This is on that Bronner Hawk story now that's on Peacock, I believe it is, or Dish Plus, Discovery Plus, I believe it was. And so under the, they put another oil cooler on it after they'd been out and made an attempt to qualify. And one of the other race teams, it tells in there in that movie, and one of the other race teams said, you can't do that. You're changing the outside appearance of the car. So they had to take that off, and they'd filed a complaint. And underneath the seat back was a wedge space of about probably 3 feet by 2 feet at an angle, and it used to be a cavity for a seat tank, and that's where some of the fuel used to be stored on car, and that wasn't in that car because it was a short track. So they decided, we're going to build a tank to go in under there and hold engine coolant or antifreeze. And so they did. And he went back out and qualified in the middle of the front row. And then he kept a pretty good pace. He kept up with first, second, and third, and they fell out toward the end of the race, and he was almost a lap ahead as they were, and that put him up front in number one spot with about eight laps to go, and his back was blistered up from all the heat. He's running 260 to 270 degrees, and he was like the top of the radiator tank, you might say, with his back.
Wow.
And then he had a tooth off the ring gear the last two laps, and he could feel something catching in it. Like he thought a U-joint was going bad. We had a half shaft U-joint on some of them that went bad. And so the rest is history. He said, I slowed down because I knew I had a lap on the field, and he did lose just about all of that, probably three-fourths of that lead in two laps, but he saved the car and he got across the start-finish line first. So it was really Mario's win. He really, in his own mind, got the car there, and the team got it all prepared for him so he could get it there, and then that ring gear was going bad, and it's just a miracle that it didn't take out the whole ring gear. But he got those two laps in, lost a lot of ground, but he still finished the race.
Do you remember who was there right with him, like who came in second, third?
Well, no, I don't.
Okay.
I know Lloyd Ruby was leading, and I can't remember the other one, but it's all in that video that's on Discovery Plus, I believe. It's a real good video. Bronner Hawk.
Gotcha. All right, so you've been able to see the technology grow this whole time. So if you just, I just kind of like to have you talk a little bit about the growth in technology for speed as well as for safety. And what do you think are some major milestones? And who are those people that made those evolutions happen to take the game to the next level for speed and safety?
Well, in the 70s, everything was turbocharged, and before that, it was normally aspirated. So the engine size from the normally aspirated engines would decrease down to, the Fords were 155 cubic inches, but the turbocharger created so much pressure with the exhaust driving it that it would force air and fuel into the cylinders at such a rate at a high speed. And when you're going that fast, you need all of the top end you can get. And that was, the turbocharging was the number one thing that really brought the speed into Indy. And then widening tires and widening wheels. And up into 74, most of the cars had an all-open bottom. There were 3.5 inches at the top height off of the ground. Then we started with aerodynamics. In 71, we were playing with wings and starting to put on more wings, and McLaren was instrumental in bringing a real beautiful package with its car. Penske had those, and Peter Revson and Mark Donahue, and might remember those two fellows. Very avid, good drivers, seasoned, and Penske's operation at that time was top drawer, and the McLarens were top drawer, and they went 11 mile an hour faster than everybody else's cars in 71, 72. They were state of the art, and there was no undercarriage windage tray yet, or ground effects cars as we call them now. And then through the 70s, they did the aerodynamics, and that changes everything because you put so much down pressure on the car, you have to spring the car with heavier springs to keep the car from bottoming out and rubbing the bottom of the track. So everything they change affects something else. And that's the interesting part and the engineering part that took over. It's engineering that really helped that. And then Tony George, and when he took over, was really dedicated to helping with safety. Phil Casey was involved with IRL big time. He was another good friend. He's out in California. He was a crew chief for Gary Bettenhausen for years and different ones. Good friend. And he was really involved with Tony George on these safer barriers and spent a lot of time on the safer barriers. They came up with an attenuator if you spun around backwards and had a impact with the wall. It didn't shove the engine and the transmission forward into the back of the driver. It assumed a lot of the G-force into that attenuator and sort of was like a huge shock absorber, you might say, and it didn't affect the chassis and engine and transmission quite as much because there was a lot of back injury and neck injuries from that. So safety has come along with technology, and now with the one car, we used to build these cars all over the country in people's shops, and they'd all have their own plan, and they'd update them from year to year. So a lot of the cars were different. A lot of them had safety issues that weren't very good, but they'd go ahead if they could qualify them, they'd pass tech, and they'd run. Now we have Dallara, which has all the cars, all the parts, and we have one engine manufacturer or two, and those supply the engines, and that sort of came in with television because of yellow flags and all of the engines blowing up during the race, during practice. If they had TV time, they had to go to a golf game in between while they cleaned the track and then come back. Maybe you can remember that with ABC. So now the TV time, they wanted no interruptions in the, you know, unless it was a wreck or something. They didn't want a blown engine. Well, can't we get engines to run and last? Well, we finally did, but we've got one or two engine builders, and you contract with them for an engine package. Nobody tears them apart in the shop anymore. In 1971, we built four engines. We had some valve issues. The valves kept breaking, and we got from 31st to 3rd in 42 laps and blew a valve. So we were flying good with the Gilmore car, Art Pollard running it. But that was just what happened to a lot of those types of cars. And now with Dallara and with the engine package, everything's the same. Dallara is a safe car. You've seen that. We just got back from Nashville, and one of the cars came up on Bourdais. Well, it was the winner in the end, but Bourdais' car, he came clear up in it and went just about straight up in the air with the front. And everything was good, safe. Put a new nose on it and came back out and wound up at the end winning that street race in Nashville last week.
So you're still going around a lot. You're still, how many races are you still trying to hit a month or every few months?
Well, we've been to five this year, and I spent a month at Indy. We have a house right back on the outside of Turn 3, and got a grandson and my second oldest son own that house and live there, and the grandson just completed mechanical engineering. He'd been working on an Indy Lights team and worked for the Speedway all through college off and on, and tech committee, and just there again was in with the right setup with mechanical engineering at school in Indianapolis, and the Speedway is involved with that program. They have a full year of motorsports with it. So we go to a lot of races and try to get to Iowa, the Speedway. They don't have one here this year, but they're trying to get it back. That's what I heard now. And Roger and several of them are working on Iowa to bring this track back into operation. It still functions, but it's not got an IndyCar race this year. So they're trying to get ovals back into the field of races. So we've always gone to that. And I usually go to Knoxville. It's 80 miles from where I live, and that's a different venue, but But with IndyCar, we go at least 5 or 6 times a year. Went up the Road America, and we usually go up there. My second oldest son used to run a Formula Ford up there. It's a good track, and we'd always go up there with IndyCars that weekend too, see old friends. And those are the pretty much the tracks we go to.
Those are what you go to. So this could kind of be a hard one, but is there anything that you would change or any situations that you regret how they panned out? Think just over the years, some benchmarks that maybe could have went a different direction that, you know, that you look back and you're like, you know, if this would have happened, would have been a totally, like maybe somebody would still be around or somebody passed or whatnot, but.
There's a big one. This goes back a ways, and it's a story in itself, but I'll tell you what I can see of it. And I'll touch on 1971, because that was my first year at Indy. That was a big year for change. But in the 50s and 60s, Tony Holman and USAC worked together. USAC was the sanctioning body of the race. Tony Holman took care of the speedway. So USAC was responsible to take care of the racing and timing, scoring, and all that stuff. Well, the USAC wanted to protect the car owners and teams and make it fair for everybody to have a chance to come and compete. But you had to be a top drawer driver. You couldn't rent a ride hardly. You couldn't buy your way in. You had to come off of these regions and be a champion in those different regions, the Southwest, Midwest, and so on and so forth. And those were where the drivers really came from in the early days. And in 71, when I was with it, I'd been working on SCCA cars, and most of the formula cars, open-wheel formula cars, were like the McLaren that came. Side radiators and wing clear across the back, front kicker wings on the nose. You could really set those cars up and make them handle. And if you go through the museum in those periods, you'll see that in 71, there were 4- and 5-year-old cars. Half of them still had open front radiators. One radiator piped the coolant clear to the front from the back and back to the engine again, so it all had to flow. And the side radiators made it so much better weight distribution-wise. They were right beside the driver, shorter path to the engine, less weight to the car, and no drag because they were in between the wheels. And the front opening of the radiator probably cut down 8 to 10 miles an hour with all that wind drag going in the front of the car. And then we got the wheels so wide in 71 that they were still running knockoff spanners, use a brass hammer, and you had to reach in about 6 inches to hit the wing on the nut. And you can look at those wheels and you see they're all beat to pieces. You couldn't hit that wing nut. In fact, Mario finished 69 on a winning car with the same right rear that he started with, because they couldn't get that spanner nut loose. And Clint had lost to Eddie Sachs before that with a tire that Eddie pulled in with 3 laps to go leading the race, and he thought he had a tire showing some cords, and it didn't matter. In 3 laps, it wouldn't have gone. And in Clint's shop in the rafters, he had those tires hanging. Every time somebody new come in, he said, "See those tires? That cost me the race." Well, he was correct, and he wasn't going to let a tire issue cost him another race. He said, "Go on out. We only got a few laps to go. That tire will make it." So I wasn't there, but that's the story. Jim McGee was there.
Present day drivers, who are you a fan of present day Indy drivers, or just it doesn't have to be Indy, it could be other, you know, forms of racing as well, but who are some of the people that you watch and that you're a fan of today?
Well, Helio Castroneves, some of my friends are on his team, and the old timers are they're in old timers, and they're they won Indy. So I got to give Helio credit and his team, MSR, Meyer Shank Racing. And Colton Hurt has just gone super. And a lot of these young people are doing so much simulator work, and now you've got Jimmy Johnson's boy growing up doing go-karts, and a lot of these kids are doing go-karts early age and simulators, and who knows what they'll be like. But Colton's just sort of a representative of that oncoming bunch, and they use the Indy Light program successfully to help groom them also. And then you jump over to NASCAR, Kyle Larson. That fella is just awesome. And he can jump in about anything. He's won Chili Bowl. He's won NASCAR events. He got into some trouble with NASCAR when he was with Ganassi and some verbal mistake. And so he was barred for a season. And he's back, and he's winning everything, and he won like 45 separate events while he was barred from NASCAR doing open wheel and midgets. He's driving for Chad Boat, Midget Racing, and Bill Boat, Chad's grandpa, and I were friends at Manzanita. Bill used to build and drive his sprint car. That was back in the 60s, and we're good friends, and Bill Boat's boy Billy Jr., which is Chad's dad, has an exhaust, stainless steel exhaust manufacturing business, and he ran Indy for AJ during the IRL split and kart split, and got the pole and almost won the race, but Kenny Brack, his teammate, got the race from him on the last lap because they ran him out of fuel. And you might remember AJ throwing the laptop down, and he said, "They ran me out of fuel. I never have run out of fuel all these years. All these computers and stuff, they ran me out of fuel," and slammed it down on the ground, busted it all. There was some footage of that. I don't know if it's still around. But that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that triggers emotions once in a while.
Sure.
And but that leads up to that split. We started there on that comment about USAC running everything, and they were protecting not changing those wheels to a hex nut for the spanner nut. And finally in 71, half of us had them and half of us didn't. And I worked at Ontario. We went to the hex nut, but it was going to cost $5,000 for the bottles, the impact wrench, the different nuts and wheels, just to supply one car for one race. And when you've got a field of 33, that means everybody has to comply if you change the rules. Well, they didn't want to keep adding cost to these cars. They just wanted to fill the field and put on a show and fill the stands with 400,000 people for the month of May. And they 100,000 came to qualifying all the time. And Tony Holman was tickled pink. And so it was a slow process. And through the 70s, Roger and a lot of the fellas that had the updated stuff and were using their heads and studying the racing industry and airflow. And Jim Hall had the Hall Chaparral, and that was really the first car. And Al Unser said when he drove it and won that year, he said it was so fast compared to what he'd been in because of that ground effects. He knew it was a coming thing. Well, then it caused the split. So in 95, I believe, or 96, the cart went out on its own, and some of them left. And the thing that I hate is that they did the split. Why couldn't they get USAC and Holman together? But they tried. A lot of those car owners tried hard. I know Roger tried hard.
Right.
And there was no other option than but to do what they did.
Right.
And then it didn't pan out very good. I went to several kart races just mainly to see some of my friends that went over to kart with them on those teams. And Jim McGee was in kart with Pat Patrick for quite a while. And I'd always make the St. Louis race because it was close, and sometimes Detroit. But that was the one thing I hated to see. Another thing that really needed done, 71 was the first year that women could come in the pits. And even some of the guys coming from England, like Clark and Graham Hill and ones, would get with Tony Holman and say, "Why don't you do something with this garage area? You should have the women in here." You know, all they had was one restroom and a shower, and it was from the 40s. And it was just a men's world. Well, they got a court order, two reporters that were female got a court order to get in, and then Tony Holman respected that, and it was open to women, but they didn't have a restroom. They had to go outside the garage area to go to the track restrooms. So in a year or two, they built the new garage area, and the cars, being aerodynamic, wouldn't go in the garages without putting boards out in front of the floor, because there was an inch and a half step to get from the gasoline alley lanes to the floor height of the garage, because we'd had so much ground clearance before in the older cars. So everybody had 16-foot 2x8s, and they'd lay those out in front of the garage floor and put the car up on those, roll it up on the boards, and then that'd be level with the floor. That's the only way you can get those cars in and out, with the ground effects trays and stuff underneath them. They were so low. Wow. So that's an area that, you know, all that could have been done by Tony Holman and a board to look into how to improve Indy, like an outlook the next 10 years or whatever.
Well, that's just kind of bringing up my next question. Sure. Is, you know, you've seen 60, 70 years of evolution.
Right.
Where do you see it going? What do you think needs to be implemented? What are some of the ideas you think that should happen? And I don't know, just kind of speak to the point of where you see the road going, and what are some ideas to make it a great road?
Well, the competition is immense, and money is one of the big factors. It takes so much money to provide these teams and these cars and put this form of racing on. And to quote Mario, you know, I like to think that faster's better. Faster's better. That's what he said all his life. I want to go faster. I want to go faster. I think we're going fast enough, Mario.
If you're not going to go faster, then are you going to be more agile? Is that
you're going to have chips in your body that improve your reaction times and all of that kind of stuff, I suppose. But I don't know really what the answer is or what the direction is, but I know they're studying it and looking at it. And oval track racing is very popular, but the oval track is sort of losing out because of the high speeds. The road courses, you got to slow them down. You got certain, you know, long stretches and sweeping turns that you can go fast on, but you get down to the 90-degree turns and recover from the speed and the braking back and forth, up and down. I think Road America, you know, that's a beautiful place up there. 4 mile track, forest all over. You can just have a family event. You can have a reunion, a get together. People come and they love to see the cars run. They don't have to run 350 miles an hour like they're doing at the drag strip now.
Right.
I think couple hundred mile an hour is enough, and they can entertain. I'm just wondering if the oval is threatened a little bit, or like Talladega, they put the bank on the oval for the NASCAR, and then they came out with the wedge plates to slow them down and limit them. And you fix the track in the car so it'll go fast. They just keep improving on the speed. There's so many minds at work. Some little thing somebody comes up with, oh, this might work, you know. And, well, there's 3 mile an hour more. Well, then everybody has to follow suit.
Right. All right, so well, go ahead.
It's definitely an engineer's world as far as car design, and that's what my grandson's doing is design. So that's where it's going to happen. And I think there'll be a limit of money eventually, because you destroy 5 or 6 of those cars, and 3 of them are in one stable, like Michael's got 5 drivers. I mean, they just can't afford to every race have a car or two lost.
Right.
I mean, eventually it's going to get to them.
All right. So what would be for an up-and-coming, inspiring driver or somebody that wants to work in the industry, what would be your advice to them?
First of all, some sort of a mechanical engineering background and training. The ability to learn today is immense, and the computer is the main tool, and knowing your way through the different computer programs and things you can find on the computer for helps. And of course they're used in scoring and timing and everything else, and data. That's one of the big areas my grandson's doing now is data entry. And so that's for driver, for mechanic, for team manager, anything like that. You're going to need some engineering. And Goodyear started that long ago with mechanics that they wouldn't hire anybody if they didn't have an engineering degree. That was back in the 80s. And from that, it sort of caught on. And I think that is number one. And then, you know, it's still going to come back down to who you know and how well you can present yourself. And once you get the nod to do something, you better be able to do it. It's not hard to get a job with an Indy team, but it's a little hard to keep one if you don't know anything.
Right. All right, so what would be, in closing, what would be one of your favorite race moments?
The Ontario 1970 and 71, we were running Art Pollard in the Gilmore broadcast special, and we led Ontario, and Jim McElreath was in second. And at the end of the race, we had the right front go flat in the backstretch coming around for the checkered flag. And we had a half a lap or better on Jim McElreath. And Pollard slowed the car enough to save the car and not hit the wall with that flat on the front. It was clear out of air, but it hadn't come off the rim yet. And McElreath caught us coming out of 4 and crossing the start-finish line by just a couple inches. It was a 1/100th of a second difference. And all Clint could say was, that cost me $62,000 between first and second. Still got 60-some thousand for second. Then the other big one would be Mario's win with that Bronner Hawk, and how the team scrambled at the end of 24 hours to get that seat tank made and allow that to get him to where he had control of the race at the end. And winning, and Mario receiving that victory kiss from Andy Granatelli, and all of the very, very good, fine things that companies provide those winners, the winning team. Clint got new Ford station wagons from Motorcraft, just all kinds of accolades, and Mario wound up with some nice contracts early on through Firestone. And back then, half the field was on Goodyear's and half the field was on Firestone's. Firestone's capitalizing on Mario after that win right away. And those were two big things. And then in 71, the ABC, it was the first time the race was ever filmed live, and it was delayed in Indianapolis till 6 o'clock, but it was a live film. And all that included was ABC with an 80-foot derrick and a platform hanging off of it in turn one, and the cameraman up there. And they were just, usually the coverage then was first, second, third, no pit, no onboard cameras. It was just a way to film the race from above. And technological advancement in television since then is just space age.
Right.
So I think that's one of the big things.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to say in closing?
Well, in closing, the friendliness of Speedway towards its participants is top drawer, they used to say when I was in IndyCar. And so many people become family, just like the old timers. We've got everybody's address and call each other from time to time. I had a lot of calls in the last year and a half or two with people sitting around with nothing to do. How you been? I wondered where you're at, you know, and are you still alive? Because there's a lot of them getting up in their 80s. But the Speedway has been so good in keeping up with all of its participants and their families and helping them keep in touch, just as you're trying to do now. And I think that's top.
Well, I think, you know, the bigger goal with what Voices of Racing is trying to do is not just, you know, let the guys tell the stories to have their voices saved for prosperity, but also so they can reminisce from each other's points of view and also be able to kind of talk about their perception of somebody else and what that person did and the impact they had on the industry. I think, like you talking about Charlie Patterson or even Troy Ruttman, you know, I look forward to having those segments as well to get your perspectives on them. But I really appreciate your time, and we're going to do a few more segments here, and I'm going to close this one out, but Dennis, just stay on the line.
Okay.
All right.
Bill Simpson is another one we should give credit to on safety. Bill Simpson was instrumental in Indy, and this is my 50th year, so I wore my 1971 uniform back there this year for the month.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, just stay on the line.
Okay.